art, culture, politics, activism. Now, art in the pandemic age. Have you ever wondered why artists do what they do? What is their purpose? What are they trying to accomplish? I'm your host, Kyle Roman. Welcome to Artivism Now. Artivism, defined, is a portmanteau word combining art and activism. How is it that artists push the boundary of their medium? How do they move societies forward? How do they resolve issues in their neighborhoods, both local and worldwide? These questions are what we set out to answer by interviewing artists locally and the world over. We will get answers to those questions that artists put out there in the community.
On today's episode of Artivism Now, we welcome Noah Scalin, mixed materials artist and painter from Richmond, Virginia.
All right, we are here with Noah Scalin. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. In looking at the work that you do, you come at your artwork from many different angles, and you utilize many different mediums, media, I should say. How would you describe, in essence, your main medium that you work within?
My main medium. I generally work with everyday materials, often things that are not considered art materials, though I do also paint. But I think as sort of what I'm known for is working with the sort of mundane materials of everyday life.
Yeah, the non-traditional, if we could say so, art materials. It's really cool because it ends up in a bunch of different unique end products. I've seen work of yours that has utilized, you know, matches, has utilized rocks, you've utilized just like food, honestly, candy.
Pretty much you name it. I think at this point, I probably work with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I think is a fascinating thing. And anybody who wants to check out your work can go, the Instagram page is actually the place to go to find a lot of your work. And if any artists are out there listening and they go to Noah Scalin on Instagram, you will see how you should use your Instagram page as an artist. It's highly organized. It's logical to click through all the different highlights and the IGTV links and everything. Maybe let's go into the Instagram platform and how you've utilized it to kind of put the word out there to your followers about your work.
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting because, I've been an artist my whole life, but I came up before the internet really was what it is now. And certainly before social media was a thing. And so the first platform I really used was blogging. To get my art into the world. And so it was back in the day when you could make a blog and get followers and have it go through Feedburner and develop these really great audiences and relationships with people. And they were mine, which, you know, anybody who's younger, who's not familiar with those days has no idea that like, that was your audience. You know, now you are beholden to a platform who can change on a whim, and they do constantly. When there was this sort of sea change away from the people going to blogging and looking more towards basically Facebook, but Twitter, Instagram, a few other places, I went ahead and set up all those pages on every platform I could think of and start putting content on all of those. And I found myself basically putting content everywhere and kind of killing myself to do it because I was rewriting the post to be unique to that platform and have the links work. And it was just nuts. And I in the last few years, basically realized that the one I was getting the most pleasure from and the most bang for my buck was Instagram before Facebook bought it, and have this basically, you know, good experience thing. It's a visual medium. It's a lot less about sort of debate and criticism, and it was a generally positive place. Mostly you were just getting likes and there weren't dislikes. It was just like either people liked it or they didn't and they went away, and it was you know, fairly benign in that way. And so my page really grew organically. And if you go, you know, if you scroll all the way back to my first post somewhere way back when, which I don't know if you know, you know, how long it would take you to scroll back to it, but I don't even know what year it was, but it was pretty early on. You know, that's back in the day of every image having a like a frame on it. They were still doing frames.
Yeah, that's right.
If you remember the early days.
I remember that.
You know, it was like random photos. And then I would put a piece of my art. And then, you know, what I did was I learned a lot from watching other people. And I also, over the last just few years, you'll see a big shift in it and basically realized that I was no longer using it as a personal means of sharing, but that it really was more of a portfolio, that a lot of people, when they look you up, aren't necessarily going to your portfolio website, which I have as well, but that they're looking to Instagram as like a place to find you. Your work gets shared and then people tag you. So it was important to maintain a presence on a visual platform as an artist that sort of represents me. So I was doing all the heavy lifting for a long time. And actually only this year, because my company has a person doing social media for our company, we brought her over to help out with my page as well. So she is the one who did that beautiful reorganization. And then my assistant made those great icons. So I will say I'm the product of many helpers now. Before it was all me, all on myself, but stories were, you know, kind of all over the place, and definitely the links that were, you know, right under the portfolio were. So I love the fact that you get to see the relaunched version from this year where it's a lot cleaner. It makes a lot more sense. And it's just great to have another set of eyes looking at it. So right now, just, you know, the way the sausage works is she, I work, so I've used the platform Patreon, and basically that's where I put my effort now. And I have a policy that basically is like, if I'm going to put effort into something, I need to get a return on it. And a lot of these social media platforms make you work really hard for very little in return. You're basically working for them, right? You're building their content library. You're building their advertising ability. And often asking you to pay for it on top of it for whatever the bells and whistles are. So I really was like, I don't want to spend that effort full time on this platform. So I spend that on Patreon, where there's people who are paying to have a really exclusive experience with me as an artist. And I love that community and I have a great connection to them. So I sort of use that as where I put my effort. And then this person that we're working with helps out by transitioning that onto this platform. And you caught me in the midst of the Creative Sprint, which is a project that my company created. There's a lot here to unpack, but with my sister, who's my business partner, this 30-day creativity challenge, and we run it for the public in October. And so every October, and we'd in the past, we've done it twice a year, but we're now doing annually. We challenge people to do 30 days of creativity where we provide a prompt basically each day in the morning and say, hey, today try this. And I always do it. So I'm not just the president, I'm a customer as well.
I'm a customer as well.
That's an old commercial for people who
that's the men's warehouse or something, right?
Or hair club for men or something. I can't remember which
there
one.
You go, hair club for men.
But basically so I always do it. It's a lot of fun. It's a good challenge. And so what you're seeing on my Instagram right now is a mix of my portfolio work being shared by our social media person, and then my daily creation that is just totally random, which is fun because it kind of just messes up the whole thing in a delightful way. But it means there's a lot more super random stuff on my feed. And then like after this month, it'll go back to like three posts a week that are a little more portfolio centric. But during this month, it's bonkers because I'm posting daily the wacky brand new things that I'm generally not spending a ton of time on either. So they're usually just sort of fun experiments. So anyway, I don't know if I answered your question. We just talked about Instagram for a while.
No, that's okay. That's totally fine. We mentioned your company, so we want to bring that up, right? It's Another Limited Rebellion, right? ALR.
Yeah.
And let's get into ALR. So what is the, what would you say the mission of ALR is to do?
Well, so ALR now, as of the last several years, is a art and innovation consultancy. And so basically it is about taking the practices of artists and teaching them to people in a variety of settings. So we work with corporations, we work with individuals, but we work a lot with organizations, government agencies, schools, but basically helping people learn how to apply creativity to their work and also to understand what creativity is and to sort of take the tool set from the artists and give it to folks who don't necessarily consider themselves artists. And also using the theater skill set that I learned in school as well. But basically this stuff that we all get from this one set of education and give it to this other world that has generally rejected that or seen it as sort of other or for only certain people. And so that's really what we do is we try to elevate the value of artists in our culture and help people find that creative essence within themselves. So it's a very satisfying job, but also a super random thing to be a consultant coming out of my own background, because I've always been an artist. My parents are artists. I've studied theater design. I ran a graphic design company. Business consultant was never on my agenda. And also I came out of activists. My mom was an activist. I grew up as an activist. I was part of the punk subculture in New York. So like, I don't know how to tell you, like, that is the weirdest thing that I have this job now, but it's actually one of the most fulfilling jobs. I think the most fulfilling job actually I've ever had.
Absolutely. It looks like that too, because of, I mean, all the different posts and what you were talking about, it kind of, is almost representative of that, you know, left versus right brain movement and how a lot of the corporations around the world are now seeking out creatives to learn how to think outside of the normal kind of prescribed solutions for their businesses or for, you know, the environment or for public agencies. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing that places who used to not value creativity are now starting to just kind of claw for it?
Oh yeah. I've been doing consulting work for about 10 years now. And even with that, in that 10-year span, I've seen a massive sea change. But when I started, there was already a movement towards this. I think the fact is that every organization that is paying attention to what's happening around them is desperate for innovation. And the way we teach it is basically to say that, like, creativity is the foundation of innovation. And so, you know, if you want this, you have to have that. And what I think a lot of big companies have realized is that they're trying to hire people and to do this job and they don't have the skill set they need. And then they've also got their existing workforce who have been trained to be very successful in certain, you know, sort of systems, but they're not great when it's about dealing with the unexpected or dealing with change or dealing with innovation. They just haven't been trained in that. And so they are desperate for it. And the cool thing is that I'm able to come in as me. I don't have to be somebody else. I don't have to do, you know, I am who I am with my background, the way I look, with my, you know, visible tattoos, whatever it is, you know, like, and it doesn't matter at all. And I work with people you would think would be incredibly conservative. I mean, bankers, you know, people who, you know, just did a couple of different bank conferences, like people that you'd be like, why on earth would they want to hear my story or do what I do, but they're desperate for it. And they're very open and receptive in a really delightful way. And you get to meet a lot of great human beings in the process, which I think is cool because I definitely would not have met them any other way in my life.
Yeah. It sounds like it. It sounds like there's a real push to generate that kind of outside of the box content for, you know, decision makers, leaders, within both the corporate world and the government world. And so are you seeing any sort of, in that work, are you seeing any sort of like, you know, sea change in terms of the hiring aspect? Because it comes down to for those corporations or for those agencies, can we get these types of people in the building to work for us? You know, are you seeing that happening in the work that you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say. I know that, I mean, because I work with a lot of HR professionals, I know that they are definitely changing the way HR is being done. I think that the old way of sort of looking for people is changing. I think people are more willing to have a broader view of what the skill set is. I think the old days it was like, do you do this, check. And I think it's a little more human now. And so I think that has happened. And I think, it, you know, the HR professionals are leading that change. And I think organizations are willing to bring in artists like me. Mm-hmm. I was in 2016, I was the first artist in residence at the VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University School of Business. And we say probably the first artist in residence at any business school in America, maybe ever. But I loved the fact that they were that forward thinking to recognize that the future of their students was going to require them to have a very different mindset, and that they were preparing them for that future by having someone like me teaching in a business school. And so I went on to teach a course in the business school after that year-long role as artist in residence. And it's wild because I don't have a business degree or background. I mean, like, I have a BFA, you know, and so to come in and be able to give useful information and open eyes in that environment has been really super satisfying.
Absolutely. That sounds like it would be, just being able to, like you said, interact with people you wouldn't normally interact with and, you know, kind of, you know, spread that, the message of artists everywhere. You know, and have people apply it. I think there really couldn't be anything bad that comes from it, especially on their end.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity there that, you know, talking about my activist background, you know, it's very weird to go into these very formal corporate settings, but I do feel like I'm sort of injecting something into this world. And I think that once you sort of see and hear what I've got to share, like you can't go back. And I see real transformation happening with people who embrace the stuff that I'm sharing. And that's pretty exciting because I know that, you know, you can seed that through an organization and see places change. You know, a few years back, there is this legislation that basically made corporations into human beings. And so if they're going to be human beings, they can't be the terrible ones that they've been. They have to become good human beings. So if I can help that transformation, then that's a good thing.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more because it really does have to change. You know, it's just not sustainable some of the ways that these corporations are run. And I think that's a great thing. And, you know, if it's good enough for, you know, Tom Morello and Rage Against the Machine to go into corporate boardrooms and teach them how to be better, right?
How are any of us
going to be hung up?
Yeah. Well, but I mean, there is, I mean, I definitely came up in the era of people being called out as sellouts. And so I definitely had some soul searching to do when I started down this path. Cause I was like, wait, aren't these the places that I was against? But what was interesting is that, you know, I was working as a graphic designer for a long time and I promised I would never make marketing messages for things I didn't believe in. I didn't want to do that. So my job was I was running what I called a socially conscious design firm. And it was very much based on my ethics. And that was, you know, I chose clients that were mostly nonprofits and theater companies and small businesses. And that's not really the client base of my consultancy, but I also am not doing marketing for them. I'm doing this other thing that's more about helping their people become better people. And so I didn't feel as bad about it.
Right. Yeah. Let's get into some of the work here. We had talked kind of pre-interview about the Cujo Lewis piece as a very unique process that you went through to create it. Walk us through, maybe give us a little synopsis of who Cujo Lewis is and then talk about your process.
Yeah. So Cujo Lewis, and of course, I'm not a historian. And so I learned this stuff in service of my art, but I always feel bad if I have to like rattle off names and dates. But he was one of the last living survivors of the last ship to come across as part of the Atlantic slave trade. And when that ship came across, it was already illegal for ships of slaves to be brought into America. Slavery was still legal, but to bring new ships in had been illegal for like 50 years at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it was like just horrendous. Every aspect of it is horrendous. But, you know, here's this last ship that they were guiltily hiding and trying to keep anyone from knowing that they were still bringing slaves, enslaved people into the South. And I encountered his photograph when in 2018, Zora Neale Hurston's book, A Barracoon, which it was an interview with him, was finally published. It was written in the 30s, but it never got published because of a variety of reasons. And so it turned up in 2018, and I saw this photo of this guy and was just like, oh my gosh, it's such a beautiful image. But also, you know, that I didn't know this history at all and felt, you know, really ignorant. And I grew up in Virginia. You know, so I grew up in the South. I grew up in Richmond, which is where I live now, which was the capital of the Confederacy. It is a place that is currently grappling with that history still. And we're seeing some transformation, and I'm a very small part of it, but I try to be a part of it here. And, you know, I didn't learn any of this in my history class, of course. I learned a totally different version of history. And I had to work really hard to learn other things, and I'm constantly learning. And so that piece, and then the one I'd done not too long previously in the same style was an experiment. And so I do a lot of work, as I said, with everyday materials, but I'm also always experimenting and trying new things. And there's a technique I developed a few years back where I used matches to burn images into different surfaces. And at first I would make an image in matches and that would be the result. And then I'd burn it. And then there'd be sort of this after image. And then I started playing with this idea of how could I make the matches burn the image into the surface. And it's good for very sort of concrete objects, but portraiture is really difficult to do this way because there's a lot of variable in this medium. It's pretty hard to control. I can get some detail out of it, but to really get the subtlety of portraiture is hard. And so I had this idea that like I was going to experiment with it. And the first one I made, I was like, this end result is dramatic, but doesn't, I think, serve the subject matter properly. So the first one I did was actually, and you can find it in my feed as well, but it's a woman named Olivia Hooker, who was one of the last living survivors of the Tulsa race massacre. And so there's another piece of history that I hadn't known a lot about until relatively recently when I learned about her history. And so that piece was an experiment where I made her the burn because I thought, you know, this represents this really destructive time. And then this etched image, this sort of brand that's put into this wood is like how we have this permanent mark from this history on our country. But the end result is so rough. And this was this beautiful photograph for that one of this child in the case of Cujo Lewis, this beautiful portrait of this older man. I just love these photos. And I felt like, you know, I'm not doing their humanness, their soul, like justice. And so I decided as an experiment on the first one I made just to paint right on top of this burn, even though the burn is really dramatic and interesting, I was like, it's not right. And so I just took a risk and painted on top of it. And I liked the result and I shared that and people really liked it. And what was interesting was I was able to share the process, which is me first laying all these matches out very, very carefully, then setting them on fire and then painting on top of them. And then I've covered the image, but there's burn is still showing through. And here's this really colorful portrait on top. So that was a learning process for me. And then I had already lined up these two images that I definitely wanted to do that I'd been thinking about for years. But that's kind of how I work is I will experiment. If I like a result, I will keep pushing myself and try to do more in that as a series. But now it's on pause until I find the next subject matter for that. Cause it was so specific. Like both of these people were these last people from these pieces of history that a lot of people don't know. And my role, you know, as someone who is not black. That's not my history. That I don't ever want to co-opt it. I want to basically say, like, this is what I'm learning, and I want to share that and share the respect and love that I have, and use my art to elevate stories through the platform that I have. And so right now, because of where I live and because of the activism I've been involved in, those stories are really important to me to focus on in the work that I've been doing recently.
Yeah, you can definitely get a whole glimpse of the process on the Instagram page. Noah Scalin on Instagram is where you could find the IGTV videos that are sped up. So
you don't have to spend days with me watching the process. Right.
Yeah, and you really do, like, you captured pictures of every step of the process, basically, and then the video kind of shows the fire igniting and then the painting over, which I think is fantastic. The fire from the matches almost kind of gives a sense of, you know, a, kind of a little reminder of the, like you had alluded to, the history you didn't learn, almost as if the pages were burned from that history. And so when I see that, I definitely get that feeling from it, almost as if the, you know, it's a representation of what happened for a lot of people. And then the painting over it, I think, is the vibrancy, is the bringing it to life. And so, you know, often, well, I'm a theater person, so life and death, right? Like, that's literally.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, and you go back to my earlier work, it was definitely about the same thing. This sort of, this finding, this striking, this balance between those things and performance as well. You know, when I do those pieces, they only, you know, the end result exists, but really it exists in the performance of the making of it, right? The creation of it, which is why I'm glad to be able to document it and share that so that people can experience the whole thing. And maybe someday I'll do them with other people around whenever that's possible again.
Right. Yeah. And it's a great documentation of the whole process. And I really think that that's what makes your work specifically unique, is that dedication to the experimentation in your process. And, you know, maybe it's because you document it that it stands out a lot more, but it really does, like, you leave no stone unturned in your process. How important is that for let's say a younger artist who's out there who maybe is in a rut or something, to understand that aspect of the work?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I've talked to a lot of people, because I didn't go to grad school for art, and I feel like a lot of times that's where maybe people are honing in on a aesthetic and a style and really building a body of work. And in college, because I didn't study fine art, you know, because I did theater, my practice was always around just being scrappy and making stuff on the fly and getting it done quickly and getting out in the world and making more. And certainly that's what I did with my own practice. And that's what we encourage with our company, is just to sort of, it's a little bit of quantity over quality, which sounds terrible to a lot of people, but that's how I keep generating new ideas and finding new bodies of work, is by doing that constant experimentation, so that I don't stagnate, I don't get bored, I don't get nailed down too long to something. It's funny, for, you know, many years I was known as the skull guy, because I did a project in 2007, 2008 called Skull a Day, which is how a lot of people found out about my work. And so for years afterwards, like, that's all people wanted to see of my work. That's what people expected of me. I still, if I put a skull up, I get, you know, tons of feedback that's positive for that. But I shifted to portraiture several years back, because I just wanted, that was interesting to me. And I felt like I'm not done with skulls ever, but I definitely didn't want to produce them at the level I was doing. I had more to explore, and I've been able to shift it to where people now recognize my other work. You know, they recognize my anamorphic portraiture, or they recognize my sticker art. And it's really cool, because that's possible. You don't have to be the dude who does, or the person who does whatever forever. And I don't think you should be. I think it, and so at least my personality is, I like to have lots of different things going at once, trying things out, completing things, experimenting, switching modalities. And that's where it keeps things fresh and exciting, and keeps me from ever feeling stuck or stagnant. And so that's not a problem I tend to have anymore. So yeah, for advice for others. Just constant experimentation on the side. It doesn't have to be your main thing, but you know, whenever I'm between doing some commissions that are in a style that people expect of me, I pull out a canvas and try something else. Or even with the creative sprint, it's great to do 30 little something else's that one of these might turn into something that I'll go back to and go, you know, playing with rubber stamps was fun. I should do that some more. Or, you know, this people really responded to that. And I never thought about making stuff that way. Every time I do one of those, I get something new out of it that I'll return to and I'll develop and find opportunity from.
Yeah. Let's stick with the creative sprint. I know you've talked about it. You brought it up a couple of times. What exactly is the creative sprint? Because you are a co-creator of that. And then, you know, let's maybe jump back into the benefits that you feel like it could offer people who are creatives, artists.
Yeah. I mean, very simply, creative sprint is a 30-day creativity challenge where we encourage you to make something daily for 30 days using prompts that we send you. The idea being that, you know, starting with a blank page is really daunting. And so rather than do that, we'll give you something to work from. It's abstract enough that you can interpret it how you want. And it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be literal. And we work with a lot of people who are non-artists, but also people who are artists. And it's a great way to just experiment, as I was talking about before, to expand your skills to play, to have fun. Maybe if art's become a drudgery, you know, that it doesn't have to be. And so we developed it, my sister, Micah, and I, for our company, and we gave it to the public as a free thing. And then we run it with versions of it with the corporate clients we have. And that whole thing is really came out of my own project, Skull a Day, because what I had done is made skull art every single day for an entire year. And that was my personal way of getting out of a creative rut at the time. And that led to all kinds of things, book deals, art shows, the ability to do teaching and consulting, the business I do today, talking to you today, everything I can basically I've done in the last many years came out of that 1 year of creative practice and experimentation and just saying, you know, creativity is a practice. If you work out your creative muscle by going to the mental gym, you can get the benefits of it. And so you don't have to do it for a year. 30 days is plenty. I tend to get good results after about 10 days personally. I think if I stick with it a little more than a week, I think like a gym or like any kind of exercise, you do it enough, you see the results. But if you do it once or twice, you're like, I hate this. You get nothing out of it and you're miserable. So, you know, that's really what our idea is encouraging people to do that and dive in on it, especially when you're feeling stuck, especially when you're feeling like, I don't have any good ideas, or I just, you know, or I can't do this. You know, somebody's feeling like they're not creative. It's amazing to watch people at all levels discover something new. And I've seen lots of people. I had actually one of my websites, I'd interviewed, I want to say well over 1,000 people who'd done some form of daily creative practice. And down the line, you know, everybody consistently would say that, you know, the more they put into it, the more they got back, but it was exponentially more.
Interesting. It just goes to show you the power of the right brain and the creatives in the world and what you could definitely generate both outward to the community and what you can generate inward can really improve your own life, lives around you. And I think that's a fascinating thing about the challenges that you put up there. In a way that is that's part of your activism is putting that creative challenge out there into the world, and people are able to take that challenge up and, you know, get better from it, heal from it. You know,
it really does make some profound transformations. And we didn't expect that. I certainly didn't expect that when I made Skull a Day that it would have this sort of global appeal, or that I would have people writing me saying, I did this with my family, or I learned this, or I grew in this way, or I brought this to students. It was a shock, but at the same time, it's incredibly humbling and also heartening to know that, like, you can touch people in this way. And really it came down to me doing something I felt passionate about and sharing it. And I think that was the thing. And that's the thing we highly encourage with Creative Sprint is we want you to make daily, but we also want you to share daily. And I think the sharing piece can be scary for people. I know a lot of people are worried about, especially with Instagram, it's like the perfect stuff all the time. It's got to be the best thing. And right. you look at other people's and it's overwhelming. And we really are like, just put it out there. Don't worry about that. Yeah. You can put something out tomorrow, the next day, and the next day. So don't obsess over this day. Do the best you can right now, but get some steps forward, because you can't get anywhere if you're not moving. Yeah. And a lot of times people are just waiting for the right thing, and they're sort of watching the escalator stairs go by and never jumping on the escalator. And it's just like, you just get on there, take some steps, and you'll do things, and then opportunities come, but they come from people who take action, and you make your own luck.
I couldn't agree more. I had a time in my life where I was just absolutely stuck and, you know, couldn't put one foot in front of the other. And I was, this is just a small story. I was, you know, kind of cruising through Berkeley out here and in the Bay Area, and we wandered into an herb store. Imagine that, an herb store in Berkeley. And I told the lady, I was like up front with her, the herbalist. I was like, you know, do you have anything, or could just help me get out of my own way? She was like, well, so you want to take the bull by the horns? I was like, yeah, I do. And she's like, well, in order to take the bull by the horns, you have to take the bull by the horns. And effectively talked me out of any product that they had in the place. But it was true. And the way that you, the story that you just told about, you know, the goals of Creative Sprint is exactly that. It sounds like, you know, just getting people to take that first step, then take another one, then get back up and take another one. And man, you really do see the results, you know, and that for me to remember that story of my life, so insignificant in passing, you know, innocuous conversation turns into this, you know, this just cornerstone moment in my young adulthood. And, you know, and it's because of someone who you know had the temerity to tell me that I have to do it. It's nothing else can do it for me. So
it's so easy and so hard at the same time. And you also don't know whose life you'll affect, right? Like that person probably had no idea that one little statement was going to stick with you and have that effect. And that's what it's like, you know, and that's why you do it. And that's why you put it out there. And because you don't know who's the one who needs to hear that and who will take action at last and make the great thing that needs to be made right now.
Yeah, and it sounds like the work that Creative Sprint is doing and that your company is doing, the consultancy ALR is doing as well, is kind of putting out there, vibrating outwards, challenging people to be more creative in their present setting. I think that is, it's very noble work. So I definitely am looking, you know, want to hear more about the work moving forward that you guys are doing. I think it's fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah, it's something that like I say, it feels good to do. And it is, you know, when you're doing the right thing, when you're like, I get a lot out of this, it's very satisfying. It's work I love. And that's a rare thing to find.
Absolutely. We like to try to do a little bit on this show about artists talking to students or people, you know, who are thinking of pursuing art. A lot of the people who listen to the show are either my former students or current students or people who are in college programs. To those who are thinking of pursuing art, lifestyle, business, you know, as a career pursuit, you know, if you could, you know, tell them something, what would you tell them?
Gosh, I mean, there's never been a better time to do it. But I think that if there was anything I wish I had done differently or was learned more about business, I think, you know, every artist to some extent is an entrepreneur, but most artists aren't taught the skills that you need to be a successful entrepreneur. And so most people make a lot of mistakes. And if you're lucky, you survive them and then you keep making more mistakes till you don't. But if you could learn some of that stuff in advance, like get an accountant or, you know, learn how to write a contract, don't work for free, like just some basic stuff, but beyond maybe what they'd give you in school, which is like make a portfolio website or whatever it is, like there's just some straight up business stuff, because the people in business school are learning all that so that they can make money to survive. And what generally happens is artists get taken advantage of because you haven't learned that piece. And so if you can get both sides of the picture, then you're going to be so much further ahead in the game. Because really, like, there's lots of opportunity out there. You just have to learn how to take that opportunity, but also how to make a living if doing it. And that's the thing, is like a lot of artists end up having to do other things to make a living because they haven't figured out how to make a living from their art. You can do it. There's lots of ways to do it. It's not going to necessarily be selling your work off of the wall in a gallery, especially these days, but there's lots of ways to make money making creative work. But you have to be very scrappy. You have to work really hard. It doesn't just come to you. It will never just turn up, you know, but if you want it, you can get it. Just, you have to do the work.
That's great advice. And honestly, something that, you know, probably a lot of artists wish they heard, you know, in the moment when they did make that decision, to really pursue the career that is being an artist, no matter what type of artist you are. It could be a dancer or a painter or a muralist or, you know, a movie maker. No matter what, you are going to have to, like you said, hustle you know, just really put yourself out there and also be your own advocate and business agent. I mean, you really have to wear a lot of different hats.
And not everybody's good at all of it, you know? So finding collaborators that are, or that want to share the burden of that, that will get you even further. So, you know, finding those great collaborators early on. I'm really lucky that my sister is my collaborator, because there's some built-in trust there because of that. Yeah. And, you know, we get along really well, but, you know, finding those people who want to do the things you want, you don't want to do, or the things that are good, people that are good at the things you aren't good at doing is really great.
Yeah. And let's kind of shift to, you know, some of the current issues, current state of the world and everything. What are you know, issues or social problems that you find kind of unearth themselves in your work, or appear, or maybe even, if not directly, maybe tangentially motivate you to create?
Yeah. I mean, as an activist, I've always had a hard time picking a cause, because I think all of them generally are valid and important. And I was always jealous of the activists that I knew, and like when coming up, that were like super dedicated to a singular thing and could put a lot of effort into it and make some movement. I thought it was great, but I couldn't do it because I was like, I care about that and that and that and that.
Yeah.
And in my art, I've been sort of shifting over the years for different topics that have, you know, the things that that make me emotional when I hear a story or see something and I want to express how I feel about it, or my ambiguity about it, my lack of knowledge about it, I'll make art about it. And so I've gone through phases of different things. Obviously right now, racial justice is on everybody's mind. It is already something that I cared a great deal about and tried to include in my work. I also made a promise to myself post 2016 election that I would no longer make images of things that I, or people that I, or objects that I didn't like, because I didn't want to give them any more my mental space or anybody else's visual space. And so I tried to focus on the things that I thought were important to look at. And so it didn't have to be positive imagery, but imagery of the things that I wanted to spend my time thinking about and have other people think about. And so that's been interesting because, you know, whether that's images of people that you should, I think, pay attention to or learn the history of, or historical moments. And it's been a great journey for me to figure that out over and over again. Like, what is the priority? What do I want to see? What do I want to put my energy into? But yeah, so racial justice, social justice issues are always going to be important to me. Environmental justice as well. And I think these days sort of cycle between those as I do different pieces. And it's hard because I think for a little while I was trying to respond in the moment. And every time something would happen, I was like, I can't make a piece of art that quickly. I can't process that quickly. And I think our culture is asking us to respond so fast to everything happening that it really puts you in a bind, because I don't think you can, you can't be fast and deep. And I think we've been encouraged to be fast, and that when we don't have the depth, we can't respond in ways that maybe give us the tools we need to get out of this situation. And so I want to have time to process things and to respond in ways that are more thoughtful, but it means that I may not be responding in real time, which can be frustrating because I'd like to have something out immediately and be like, oh, this just happened and here's my response. And instead, sometimes I'm putting up pieces like, well, this was a thing I was thinking about last year, you know, and I get we've moved on, but that isn't done. It's just because it's done because the news cycle has shifted, but this is still relevant. And the you know, the, I guess the saddest part of our most recent, you know, moment around racial justice is that I was working on topics about it several years ago and they became really relevant again. And it was like sad for that to be the case. I mean, it, you know, I certainly didn't expect it to change radically in my lifetime anyway, but you know, it's like, oh, this stuff is so impression. And you're like, well, it's not really, it's just that this is the stuff we've been dealing with for a century here. And so, or, you know, or centuries, I should say. And so, you know, it's worth continuing to explore, but also to say that like, I can't, so for me, it's like, it's hard because I want to be an activist, artist, both, and sort of find ways to merge those tendencies, but in a productive way.
Right. And, you know, also not buying into the instant response, you know, culture that, that is going on both, you know, right now, everything is online because of the pandemic, and that's how we cheat, you know, pretty much communicate at this point. But, you know, sometimes we do need to revisit. We do need to cycle back. Anybody who's a teacher will tell you, you don't just teach and move on. You come back to things, right? Yeah. And you cycle back to them and touch on them and revisit and reexamine. And so I feel like the pace to which that your work is able to respond, it's no wonder that it comes back, because that's kind of just the natural cycle of things.
Yeah.
And then of course, right, the racial justice issue hasn't gone away. I mean, if you thought it was going to go away after Trayvon Martin, and then you had Michael Brown, and then you had the Ferguson, you know, riots and protests, and then all of a sudden the George Floyd, and a few years later. And so it's constantly right now, And maybe it is a good thing that there are more eyes open and more ways to communicate instantly for that specific reason.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, if there's any positive of the pandemic, it's that there were people who had time on their hands because they were home and they weren't necessarily their jobs or school or whatever, and were tired of being cooped up. And so it kind of was the perfect storm in that way for like a lot more people to get involved. That and it's good. I mean, that's a good thing. I think, you know, a lot more young people are on the streets protesting and protesting regularly. And I was doing that in the 90s. And so it was exciting to sort of, as I've gotten older and I'm less the person to be on the front lines, to see the next generation be very active and energetic, but also have all these other tools that we didn't have. You know, when we were on the streets, it was so hard to get information and so hard to figure out who was where and how to support each other and where to send money and what to do. And now it's so much easier, but the trick is then to how to parse it all and how to not get just burned out even faster. Cause we were all really burned out after doing activism for years. And I gotta imagine that these kids are gonna be really burned out after just doing it for a summer. Cause they're just burning so hot right now. I mean, it's just so intense and it's so nonstop.
Yeah, I was just talking about that activist burnout with another guest at Shelby X Studios, Grace Kress. And, you know, she talked about activist burnout from her upbringing and, you know, her parents were activists just like yours, and you were kind of born into it. And you know, when it was your turn, you would take to the streets. But like you said, it does, especially if you're the type of person who was, you know, maybe tear gassed or, you know, maybe beat up or maybe even thrown in prison. And then you had to, deal with that whole trauma, to go along with the trauma of the actual thing that you were protesting. It takes a toll on you. And so, I appreciate you bringing that up, because that's a very real thing that artists and activists do have to go through.
And I think also because you're expecting change at a certain pace that just, right. You know, it's really hard when you don't see the success you were hoping for from your protests, from your activism. And it's really easy then for people to give up, be like, I did all this, I fought so hard, and then nothing changed. Yeah. And you're like, no, it changed. We are getting better. It's incremental. You have these big things and then these little things, but we keep moving forward. Yeah. And you know, we might take two steps forward, one step back, but we will move forward.
Yeah.
But you have to take that longer view. And we are seeing change happen. It's yeah. pretty remarkable in ways that we didn't think we'd see it. I certainly didn't think I'd see some of this happening in my lifetime. So it's yeah. exciting. But yeah, there's a difference between that sort of younger energy that you bring to it and sort of the older, more nuanced perspective, I guess, that you, yeah. you eventually gain about it. But you need both in the activism world. So yeah, right. So I appreciate the kids, I will say. They're doing great work right now.
They really are. They're showing up in numbers and not just here, elsewhere. Just a couple days ago, in Bolivia, right? The former military coup in Bolivia of about 1 year old, you know, gets reversed in the elections. And so that didn't usually happen. You know, growing up in the 80s and the 90s, it was like, oh, there's a military coup in South America. Nothing's going to happen for a decade, if not more, you know?
Right.
And so now the people power is definitely growing. And so, that's a good thing. That's a positive thing, for those who are, you know, out there protesting and advocating for social justice. So, but yeah, it's a very real thing. And, you know, thank you to your parents and yourself. My era was the early 2000s, the Bush era. That's when I was, you know, hitting the streets, going to the protests and everything. And even then I don't even feel like we accomplished half as much, maybe even less than the kids who are out there now. And so, yeah. And so definitely kudos to them. And from everywhere, right? You're probably seeing a lot in Richmond. You know, being in Virginia and the cities on the East Coast, what is it about, what goes on in Virginia at the protests that is unique maybe to the movement?
I you know, what's interesting is, so I mean, I'm in Richmond, which, you know, as much as Virginia is part of the South, Richmond is such an urban, modern city. It's got an art school right in the middle, you know, very well-known schools. And so I love that creative energy really burst forth. And we have this street of Confederate monuments called Monument Avenue that I grew up in the shadow of, not even really questioning. I mean, we used to make fun of it, like Street of Second Place Trophies is what we'd call it, because we were like, you know, the losers get trophies. This doesn't make any sense. They have the, you know, but it was always just like this weird thing. But then when I learned the history of it, that the fact that they were built so much later, this wasn't really, right after the war to commemorate, this was very specifically, meant to oppress Black people, to remind them of who really had power after emancipation, after, you know, this is part of the Jim Crow era. So
yeah,
to learn how just horrendous and horrible these, and truly racist these monuments were, and that they remain standing, and that there is sort of this quaint thing that people would, you know, like, oh, come to Richmond and look at, you know, history.
Yeah.
And so I had really been like, these need to go. And there was so much pushback from people that were like, even on the activist side, well, it's not the priority, or, well, they've been here so long, oh, it's history, whatever. And then to have the activists, these protest kids, you know, out of the street, just like, just run down the street, tag them all up, which was awesome. And then start pulling them down and pulling down, like, also the Columbus statue came down. I was like, this is amazing. Yeah. I hate that statue. And like, they just did it. They just went and tore it down. And there was a lot of them and no one stopped them. And then the Parks Department was like, I guess we'll put this in storage now. And it was like, this is unbelievable. And so they like got, and then the city was like, well, this is a dangerous hazard. And even though they'd been studying what to do and nothing was happening, like after the protests were consistent enough that the city said, let's just go ahead and take the rest down. The only one they couldn't take down is the Lee Monument, which is the biggest one. It's massive. It's been embroiled in a court case. But what I love about it, and what is so, I think, Richmond about it, is that that statue now was just named one of the top 25 pieces of activist art since World War II by New York Times. And what it is that the community came, covered in graffiti, said, because people have been saying, oh, it needs context. So they said, okay, I'll give you context. We'll just write all over it, Black Lives Matter. And here's all the names of the people, these Black people who have been murdered by the police. And so they put like these memorial markers all around it. They put a big sign that says a Marcus David Peters Circle. And Marcus David Peters was a Richmond man who was killed by the police when he was having a psychological issue. And so like they branded it like, it's not the Lee Monument anymore. And so even though this stupid horse and rider are on top of it, like you don't even see it because it's just everything else. And now these guys brought projections onto it. And so every night there's like gorgeous projections. And I just thought like, this has become this very appealing, positive place that before you'd be like, I walk a dog there or whatever. Now people congregate, there's basketball nets, there's a community garden growing, there's people teaching, there's music, there's events. And that positive creative energy was already in our community, but it just got expressed in this location, this placemaking. We hear this term all the time. And like the community made that. That wasn't anything else. And it is a welcoming, amazing, diverse environment that has thrived despite many efforts to stop it. And it's still working its way through the court system, trying to figure out how to finally officially change it. But it didn't matter because the community did that. And that's Richmond.
That's fascinating. Well, I feel like we could talk all night about a lot of these issues. I definitely want to let you go, get back to your family before the evening hits. It's already hit.
I'm a few hours. It's already evening, way evening here.
So thank you so much for being on the program.
You're welcome.
Can't wait to see what else you do and what other ways in which that you could enrich the area that you're in. So thanks again, Noah, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Excellent. You're very welcome.
Special thanks to Noah Scalin for joining us on tonight's episode of Artivism Now. You can find all his links on his Instagram page at Noah Scalin. Other links to patronize ALR Creates, at Creative Sprint on Instagram, and on his link tree on Instagram, you could check out his Patreon. Search Noah Scalin. And remember, artists out there, keep it lit, let it flow, let it mean something, and goodbye.